This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Buddhism on Air, a weekly program on the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha presented by Tenzin Chozong, a monk in the Tibetan tradition. The program is sponsored by Yulan Zhu, Julie Wong, and the Buddha Youth Association. Hello and welcome to Buddhism on Air. As I will be conducting the program, let me introduce myself. My name is Tenzin Chozong, and I'm a Buddhist monk. Most of my training has been in the Tibetan Gelugpa tradition, but I like to think of myself as just a monk who follows as much as he can the Buddha's teachings. I can't say I know much about the teachings at all, but it seems to me all the Buddhist traditions, Thai, Tibetan, Sri Lankan, Chinese, Vietnamese, Burmese, Japanese, and all the others, have many excellent practices to change our minds, so it's a pity just to get too blinkered about one tradition only. Also, if we identify too closely with a single tradition, there is a danger that we may start thinking our tradition is the best and something is not quite right with the others. I have heard of people who say this sort of thing, and I think it's very unfortunate. It contributes to sectarianism, which in Buddhism is really something we should avoid. One of the big disservices we can do for the teachings of the Buddha is to promote divisions amongst his followers. Having said that, though, because most of my training has been with the Tibetans, naturally my approach will come from that tradition. But I also work quite a lot with Sri Lankan Buddhists, so I have a little familiarity with that tradition as well. Anyway, I've been a Buddhist since about 1989, and was fully ordained as a monk in 1998 by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Although I've been ordained now for 12 years, I haven't studied much, and so I'm not very knowledgeable. So I hope you'll not take what I say in these programs as gospel truth, but will think about it carefully and do some further research and reading. Then make up your own mind whether it's worth anything or not. If it is, and you can use it in your own life, then the purpose of the programs will be fulfilled. But if you don't think what I say has much value, it's better just to forget it and find something else to give meaning to your life. Because that's really what we want, isn't it? We want our life to be meaningful, because then at least we can get some satisfaction out of it. If, when we're about to die, we see some value in the life we've led, that it has some beneficial effects, then we can die comparatively happy and peacefully. But if we think our life has just been a waste of time, how will we feel when we're staring death in the face? Probably not so good, don't you think? So now, while we're alive and have good health and conditions, we have a great opportunity to stop and think about what will make our life meaningful and what will not, and then go about making it meaningful. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the aim of the Buddha's teachings on a basic level. I know some listeners may be familiar with the teachings, but for anyone new to Buddhism, I'd like to talk about its general aim. Those who already know a lot about it, please be patient. The Buddha set out to find out if it was possible to attain long-term happiness and to be free from all suffering. Now, in terms of a life of meaning, we spoke about earlier, you might say that that's not a very meaningful goal. You might think that becoming a hugely successful businessman, or a highly regarded professor or a great surgeon, or even a superstar in music or film like Russell Crowe, would be more meaningful. And to a certain extent, you may be right. For instance, if I'm a couch potato whose day consists of eating, drinking, and going to the toilet and watching TV, then no doubt a brain surgeon's life would be more useful than mine. But that really wasn't what the Buddha was concerned about. If we look closely at every single action we do in our lives, we can see that it's aimed at gaining something and avoiding something. What's it aimed at gaining? Happiness, of course. And what is it aimed at avoiding? Suffering. And here I don't mean suffering only in the sense of getting sick or being involved in an accident or having a relationship breakup, the usual stuff we call suffering. I mean every type of discomfort, even down to shifting in our seat. For instance, why do we eat? To gain the happiness of good tastes and a full stomach and be free from the suffering of hunger. Why do we watch TV? To be free of suffering of boredom and have the happiness of being entertained. Why do we want a partner? To be free of the suffering of loneliness and to have the happiness of feeling loved and wanted. Why do we work? So we have enough resources to be free of hunger, thirst, heat and cold, and so on. With the money we make, we can avoid all those things which are sufferings and get the opposite for ourselves. A full stomach, a nice shelter, pleasant temperatures and so on, which we regard as bringing happiness. And aren't we better able to attract somebody else to share our life if we have good resources than if we can't offer them anything? Think about every little act you do and see if it's not aimed at bringing you some sort of happiness or freeing you from some kind of suffering. So we could say that the meaning of our life is to gain happiness and to free ourselves from suffering. Now, if this is true, the next question must be whether we can get long-term happiness or if we always have to put up with short-term pleasures. Because if we look at the happinesses we experience every day, all are short-term. For instance, eating a nice meal satisfies our hunger for a few hours, but then we get hungry and have to eat all over again. Seeing one movie is okay for a while, but then after some time we want to see another one. In terms of computer games, some people's level of satisfaction is very short. They finish one game and almost immediately afterwards have to start the next. I heard of one person, a musician actually, who started playing computer games and for the next two weeks he couldn't do anything else. He said he virtually didn't even eat or sleep. Anyway, generally we can say our happiness has quickly come to an end and then we have to go off in search of others all over again. So the Buddha wasn't so silly after all. We can see that gaining lasting happiness and freeing ourselves completely from suffering would really be most worthwhile, especially if we can help others do the same thing. Imagine, if we were all completely happy, we would have no cause to argue with others, to belittle them, to make them feel miserable, even to torture or kill them. We only do such terrible things to each other because we feel some kind of lack or threat, some kind of unhappiness, and get the strange idea that harming others will make that unhappiness go away. From a Buddhist point of view, harming others is like a magnet for suffering. Now, if we want to experience long-term happiness, we have to create its causes and get rid of the obstacles to it. That is true of everything we do. For instance, if you want to be like Russell Crowe, you will probably get a very short and uncomfortable answer if you present yourself to a movie studio, tell them you think you're the greatest actor since Laurence Olivier, and you expect them to give you the lead in their next blockbuster. You have to be very focused on acting, learn how to make your body and its expressions do the things that will impress an audience. You have to learn stage and camera techniques and a host of other things before you even have a chance to become a secondary character. Similarly, to gain long-lasting happiness, we have to know what the causes are and create those and get rid of the obstacles that prevent our happiness and just bring on suffering. In the same way, as if we have an awfully croaky voice, we would have to train it properly for the stage or screen. So that is what the Buddha's teachings are all about. Finding the cause for happiness and cultivating those, and finding the causes for suffering, which are the obstacles to happiness, and stopping those. And in the coming weeks, I'm going to be talking about just that. The structure of this series of radio programs will follow what in Tibetan tradition is called the Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment. The Lam Rim follows the path, one topic at a time, until the attainment of ultimate happiness and peace, which we call enlightenment. This is really the most important path we can take in our lives. But before we start on the actual topics, I would like to say something about the method for making our minds and hearts one with the teachings. As you probably know, the main method of doing that in Buddhism is meditation. In the West, when we talk about meditation, most people think we're talking about stilling the mind. Westerners think that making the mind still and peaceful will cure them of their suffering, and to a certain extent it will. When we become good meditators, one of the effects is a very stable, still mind. But that is not the main purpose of Buddhist meditation. In some other traditions, it is, and when people get that extremely well-focused, quiet mind, they think they've reached the ultimate peace. From a Buddhist point of view, they haven't. It's the same kind of happiness as all our others. It may last for a time, sometimes a very long time, even lifetimes, but in the end, it will, like all our other worldly pleasures, come to an end, and we will be left with dissatisfaction yet once again. Meditation is the method by which we create and become used to the causes for happiness, and also by which we eliminate the causes for suffering. In the Tibetan, the word for meditation has the connotation of familiarization. In other words, meditation is making the mind familiar. Of course, every day we make the mind familiar with something. When I go onto the computer and pick out the news stories to read for the day, I make my mind familiar with those types of stories, and so I tend to pick out the same sorts of stories every day. I do this again and again, and so strengthen the effects of that kind of story in my life. Some people say that watching violent movies is okay. Everybody knows that they are just make-believe. But that misses the point. The more violence we watch, the more the mind becomes attuned to violence. We become used to violent practices and, in a subliminal way, take on the idea that being violent is okay. In other words, we make our minds familiar with violence. If we allow our kids to watch violent movies, we can't then expect them not to act out violently. Meditation is the same. It's a way to consciously make our mind familiar with whatever we're meditating on. Usually meditation is used to make the mind more useful to being peaceful, compassionate, and wise. But if somebody, for instance, criticizes us in the morning, we can spend the rest of the day going over and over the incident in our mind, plotting ways to get revenge. This is also meditating. It's making the mind familiar. But instead of making the mind familiar with peace and calm, this kind of meditation makes the mind turbulent and upset. Instead of increasing our compassion, it increases our anger. And so instead of leading to happiness, it leads to its opposite, suffering and pain. Of course, in Buddhism, the purpose of meditation is to bring happiness, both in the short and the long term. So we do not meditate on revenge and hatred, but rather love and forgiveness. Why? Because in the long term, love and forgiveness brings happiness and revenge, and hatred bring lots of suffering. For example, in 2008, the BBC ran a news item about blood feuds in Albania. It used as an example an 11-year-old boy, Nikolin, who has to stay at home all the time because of a blood feud with another family. When a teenager, 30 years ago, Nicolin's father had killed another man in a minor argument, and the victim's family had evoked kanun against his family. Kanun allows one family to take blood revenge on any male of another family who have harmed them, except in their own houses. So now, Nicolin and his brothers are practically imprisoned in their homes and cannot even go to school. Nicolin's father spent 15 years in jail for the murder, but the other family refuses to forgive and will kill any male from his family if they get the chance. Now this could go on for centuries. Albania's NGO, the National Reconciliation Committee, estimates that up to 800 children are imprisoned in their homes because of blood feuds. Now isn't that stupid? If Nicolin's family and the other family had talked it out, forgiven and generated love for each other, they could now be excellent friends, never afraid of helping each other and not at all scared of leaving their houses. So that is why we meditate on love and compassion and not on revenge and hatred. Now, when we talk about meditation, people use many kinds. Some just follow the coming and going of the breath. Some meditate on the constituents of the body or mind. Some combine those with walking meditations. The Tibetans of the Kalukpa tradition prefer analytical meditations which look closely at a behavior or an attitude to see if it brings the rewards it promises or the opposite. Whatever internal process brings suffering is transformed to one that brings the cause for happiness. The Tibetans also use visualizations. If you're a Tibetan, you can get used to very complex visualizations quite early. Maybe you will have seen the very colorful paintings and appliqué of the Tibetan religious pictures they call tankas. They show some of the visualizations the great masters have experienced. For us Westerners, however, such rich visualizations may be a bit difficult, at least until we are more accustomed to them. However, whatever the meditation, we're all geared to make us more familiar with the causes for happiness and less concerned with whatever will bring us suffering. The best meditation is free from distractions, so that the whole attention is focused on the object we're meditating on. Usually, as we go through our day, we may notice how scattered the mind is. It hops like a monkey from one thing to another, hardly still for a moment. We can start thinking about one thing, but before we know it, the mind has switched completely and is focused on something totally different. This continues constantly, so that most of our time is spent in distraction. In meditation, we put ourselves in a position where we have the best opportunity to focus the mind and keep it focused. That means we sit in a comfortable position, in a place where there are no loud noises, and where outside forces like children, partners, animals and friends and so on can make no demands on us. We focus our minds as much as possible on the object of meditation, perhaps the breath, for instance, at the point where the breath enters and leaves the body. If you're breathing through your nose, then it'll be at the entrance of the nostrils. If at the mouth, the point will be at the lips. Each time the mind wanders, we bring it gently back to concentrate on the meditation object again. If we make sure the mind stays alert and focused and do the practice regularly, over some time we will notice changes happening in our mind. We might find it easier to concentrate, the mind becomes more calm, and we experience less upsets in our life. That is the effect of meditation. Like most other things, if we practice consistently, we will get better and better and start to experience the results we're looking for. If we only meditate once or twice a week, not much will happen. In the same way as if we want to learn to swim well, we need to get into the water and practice a lot. The point is that the more focused the mind, the deeper the impression we can make on our psyche. If we do something over and over with a very focused mind, it can make an extremely deep impression. If, however, we only think of something a little with a distracted mind, the effect will be fleeting and, in the end, negligible. So, we want to make the mind as concentrated as possible to focus on our object of meditation. When teachers talk about freeing ourselves from suffering and gaining complete happiness through meditation, it can really inspire people. Of course, we all have problems and difficulties, and we all want to be free of them. You may not think so, because when you look around, you might see people who are rich and popular, or who seem to bounce through life without a care in the world. How can they have problems, you might think? But if you start speaking to them, you soon realize that they too have things in their lives that are not satisfactory, things they want to change. I like the quote by Brad Pitt. "Fame is a bitch, man," he said. In fact, nobody in our type of existence has perfect happiness. Dissatisfaction is woven into this type of existence. like the nature of water is to be wet, the nature of our type of existence is dissatisfaction. This is one of the things the Buddha discovered when he set out on his quest to find the way to perfect happiness. One of the four seals, which distinguishes Buddhism from other faiths, states, "All contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering." This means that everything associated with our emotions has the potential to bring us dissatisfaction and suffering. And we are continually generating emotional reactions to situations and people, so we are constantly in the presence of dissatisfaction. So when people hear about the path to enlightenment, they can get very enthusiastic and think of dropping everything to go off into the mountains to meditate and get enlightened quickly. We Westerners are especially prone to this kind of attitude because we often operate on the principle, I want it, and I want it now. In the same way as we go to university and get a degree in 3 years, we think we can take a few teachings, sit on a cushion for a year or two, and that's it, we'll be Buddha. In fact, when I started out in Buddhism, I had a similar idea. I liked meditating, and my mind became relatively quiet quite quickly, so I thought I would make good progress towards enlightenment. 20 years further on, and I haven't really moved much from that initial position. In an even more radical example, a long time ago in the 9th and 10th centuries of the Common Era, lived a very famous Tibetan yogi by the name of Milarepa. He has an extraordinary life story, very recently made into a film in 2 parts. The first part has been released. The second is due out sometime this year. Anyway, Milarepa was regarded as a very highly realized being and was renowned for meditating in Tibet's mountains and for the teachings he wrote in the forms of songs. If you want to investigate, you can get books of his songs from websites like Amazon and ABE Books. Sometime after he passed away, a rich Tibetan merchant heard about him and his teachings and was very inspired. In fact, he was so inspired that he gave away all his riches and, against the advice of all his friends and relatives, went into the mountains to meditate and gain enlightenment, just like Milarepa. 3 weeks later, he was back complaining bitterly that Milarepa had deceived him and all he had gained was poverty. The difference between Milarepa and the Tibetan merchant was that Milarepa had a teacher, had taken many teachings, and contemplated well before he went into the mountains. He had spent a long time with his teacher, really finding out how to meditate and what to meditate on, before his teacher allowed him to go and sit in a cave. So he was well prepared, while the merchant wasn't prepared at all. And then Milarepa spent many years meditating in the most difficult of circumstances. Can you imagine sitting in a cave up in the Himalayas while a blizzard howls outside? And he didn't have any thermal underwear, fur-lined clothes and thermoses of hot soup to keep him warm. In fact, in the later stages, he didn't have any clothes at all. The point of this story is that before we let our enthusiasm run away with us, we have to make a lot of preparations. Of course, enthusiasm is very important and necessary throughout our whole Buddhist journey. But just as important is knowledge and the understanding how to apply that knowledge. If we are going to embark on the Buddhist path, we have to know what the path is, where it leads, and how we're supposed to follow it. Otherwise, we could just find ourselves going in an opposite direction or going exactly nowhere, like the Tibetan merchant. That is why it is important to first listen to the Buddhist teachings and see how well they fit with our experience. The Buddha never said that we should just follow him blindly. He was adamant that he is not our savior. What were his words again? Believe nothing, no matter where you read it or who said it, no matter if I said it, unless it agrees with your own reason and your own common sense. He also said, no one saves us but ourselves. No one can and no one may. We ourselves must walk the path. And of his teachings, he told his monks, O monks, just as a goldsmith tests his gold, by melting, cutting and rubbing. Sages accept my teaching after full examination and not just out of devotion to me. He was saying, in the same way as a goldsmith who wants to buy some gold will first test it in every way he can to determine its quality, so we must test the Buddha's teachings to see if they fit with our experience and what we want to achieve. Only when we are totally satisfied that the Buddha is telling the truth and we are able to follow his path should we become his followers, not just because we have some kind of devotion for him. If we don't know what the Buddha was talking about, we cannot meditate on the Buddhist path, and we cannot then attain the results of that path. So it's vital to first listen to the teachings, then to use our wisdom to thoroughly contemplate on what we've heard, matching it with our own experience. We must all do that before we start to practice. Even if we've come across a very charismatic and persuasive teacher who seems to have all the answers and be on a very much higher plane than ourselves, we have to be careful. Buddhism, like other religions, is littered with stories of teachers who have gathered many students and then abused their students in one way or another. In the West, it is easy for students to become fascinated by exotic Eastern teachers and to give themselves wholly over to the instructions. If these instructions are misleading or false, or the teacher misbehaves, the students can find themselves in a lot of trouble. Now, as we come towards the end of this program, let's think for a moment about what makes a person a follower of the Buddha. A book recently published by a great Buddhist master by the name of Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche addresses this subject very well. The book is called What Makes You Not a Buddhist? And if you want to read it, I think you'll probably be able to find it on Amazon. You might also have come across Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche in another context. He was the director of the films The Cup and Travelers and Magicians. Early on in his book, he says that if you believe in the four seals, you are a Buddhist, but if you don't, you are not, even though you may call yourself a Buddhist. I will explain these a little more in our next program. But now we've come to the end of our time together. Thank you for joining us, and please tune again next week at the same time. Goodbye.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.